So it was about 15 years ago that I first preached a sermon, and the title of that sermon was called American Fascism, Can It Happen Here? And I remember that time my congregation in Cincinnati, you know, were polite, but I don't think that they were really on board with what I was saying. That's fine. You don't have to be on board with me. You really don't. And about 6 years ago, I preached another sermon on fascism here at this congregation. You might remember it. And then it was much more in the news. People were talking about it more. And now today, it's very difficult to have a discussion about American politics without talking about fascism. And so I wanted to talk about this today. So what is it? Fascism, first of all, is an authoritarian movement. It is anti-democratic. It is anti-egalitarian. And it's about really about minority rule, about the place and power of a minority within a particular nation. In Germany, the Nazis never had more than 37% of the vote. So there was a minority movement even in Nazi Germany. And another thing about fascism is in this authoritarian, it's a particular kind of authoritarianism where the society is sharply divided between us versus them. And so it's a sneaky kind of authoritarianism where the government is controlled to serve a minority and not the majority. In a democratic system, majority vote wins. In a fascist system, that's not the case. The second thing about fascism is that it's tribal. And you have this groupthink, and often it's based on this notion of supremacy. You know, my group is better than your group. There's a purity factor. And in the United States and in Europe, it's often this supremacy is often Christian and white. It's also theocratic, that is, it talks about God's chosen people. And in addition to this tribal aspect of fascism, there's a certain kind of nationalism or a false patriotism and a militarism that's connected to fascism. And those who are, there's also a lot of corruption. And the way you can tell there's a lot of corruption is that you can tell who is being who is above the law and who's not above the law, that there is a group that is not prosecuted and is not held accountable, and there's the rest of the people who have a different standard. Okay, so it's authoritarian. And also, it is a highly unequal society. That is, ruled by usually a supreme leader or a political cadre, and also an oligarchy, a plutocracy. And so the elite and the leader, supreme leader, basically call the shots, and there's a concentration of wealth and power into the elite. And what we're seeing in our country, by the way, is the greatest concentration of wealth that have ever existed in the history of our country, greater even than 1929. And so there's a kind of, in this unequal society, there is a crony capitalism where there is special favors being done for people within that system of capitalism. The fourth thing about capitalism is, or excuse me, about authoritarian fascism, is that hatred is the oxygen. It's a kind of authoritarianism of division where there is a high degree of hatred that makes it possible. And so you have a list of scapegoats, a list of enemies who are often targeted with violent threats and intimidation. And for example, in our country, we're seeing a lot of scapegoating going on right now. We're seeing high degrees of racism, victimizing certain people in our society, sexism, xenophobia, a demonizing, for example, of migrants and immigrants. It's anti-labor, and so all these groups are focuses of hatred, which allows fascism to work. Also, LGBTQ persons, liberals, all of these fall in the category of the other, those who are outside of the group. See? And what happens is that you have this alliance. So fascism is a certain kind of authoritarianism where there's alliance between the elite, the oligarchic, the plutocracy, and these people who are motivated by hatred and anger. So you have this alliance between the oligarchy and this militant group of angry losers. They're chumps who enable minority rule. And I'll say something more about this a little bit later. And so it's through this manipulation and deceit that this anger is fomented. And they see these outside groups, all of these outside groups, they see as the problem rather than the ruling elite who are robbing them blind, robbing us all blind. So that's a thumbnail sketch, I think, of what fascism is. I've done a lot of reading and studying over this. As I said, I've been talking about this at least over 15 years now. In 1944, the New York Times asked the then Vice President Henry Wallace to write an article about fascism, answering the questions, what is fascism? And he said that American fascists are most easily recognized by the deliberate perversion of truth and fact. Does that sound familiar? Their newspaper and propaganda carefully cultivate every fissure of disunity. They claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. They demand free enterprise, but they are spokesmen for monopoly invested interests. Their final objective, toward which all of their deceit is directed, said Wallace, is to capture political power so that using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common man in eternal subjection. Now, so Wallace, I want you to understand, is using a classical definition of the word fascist, the definition that Mussolini had when he claimed to have invented the word, saying fascism should be more appropriately be called corporatism. This is Mussolini, because it is a merger of state and corporate power. The American Heritage Dictionary defines fascism as a system of government that exercises a dictatorship of the extreme right, typically through merging of state and business leadership together with belligerent nationalism. And so today, I think what we're seeing is this ascendancy of corporate power in its merger with the state. For example, the Supreme Court Citizen United decision gave corporations birth and status of human beings, with First Amendment rights to dominate political discourse. And so Wallace expands on fascism in this sense. He said, Still another danger is represented by those who are paying lip service to democracy and the common welfare in their insatiable greed for money and power, which money gives, he says. They do not hesitate surreptitiously to evade the laws designed to safeguard the public from monopolistic extortion. And so what Wallace is talking about is a situation in which the rich are getting richer on the backs of the poor and the middle class, these giant corporations wiping out small and medium-sized businesses, and a corporate iron fist grabs control of the government itself. And as Hitler did with trade union leaders and the Jews, the fascists then point to them, to the other, to distract people from the real cause of the economic harm, which is corporate power. And so there's this alliance, you know, between the oligarchy, this growing strength of corporatism, and this other group that is ideologically motivated. I'm going to talk more about that. So, leads me to another term here. And the other term is Christofascism. This was a term that was coined by one of my favorite professors. Her name was Dorte Zola, who herself was a survivor of the concentration camps in Germany, World War II. She taught theology at Union Seminary in New York, and she coined the term Christofascism, which basically talks about the intermingling of Christianity and fascism, the connection encompassing these imperialistic and totalitarian aspects of the Christian church. And so it's kind of familiar, it's kind of something that Sinclair Lewis alluded to when he had that. It's a famous statement attributed to him. It's not clear that he actually said it, but the statement is in your bulletin. It says, when fascism comes to the United States, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross. See? And so it's this merging of a particular kind of Christianity with a particular kind of political ideology to take over and assert a minority rule in a democratic society. So, I think what we've seen is a lot of examples of this Christofascism, or you might also call it white Christian nationalism, this movement that's growing in the United States, where they use Christian language to closet and to cloak sexism and anti-LGBT rhetoric and hostility to Black people and non-white immigrants in a quest to create a white Christian America. A report from the Baptist Joint Commission Committee on Religious Liberty, not a liberal institution at all, says that they found that Christian nationalism was used to bolster and to justify and to intensify the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And so what they do is they believe that the U.S. is a Christian nation, which is not the case. It was intentionally not a Christian nation. And it contradicts, and it's all about, they ignore the fact that in the United States, we have oppressed minorities. They ignore the fact that we oppressed indigenous people. They ignore the fact that we had institutionalized slavery for hundreds of years. They want to wipe that away from the history books. And we're seeing that happen right now in school districts across the nation, because they want to go back to this so-called Christian America. Now, there's a theologian and historian, Christian Dumais, who teaches at one of my old schools, Calvin University, a fairly conservative school in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And she says that these Christian fascists or white nationalists want the warrior Christ who wields a bloody sword and defeats his enemies. And they follow kind of this ends justified means mentality. And it's completely unhinged from the Jesus that we all know, the Jesus of peace, the Jesus of justice, the Jesus of inclusion, the Jesus of the Gospels. You see, the Jesus who stood for the outsider, who was on the side of the oppressed. You see. And so their image of Jesus is this warrior Jesus who will conquer all of their foes with violence. And so, by the way, this particular group of white Christian nationalists believe the Second Amendment was instituted and handed down by God. And so they are also very willing to resort to violence in order to, quote, save the country. And so they believe that some votes count and some votes shouldn't count. And so you see these efforts to purge the voting rolls in states. You see these efforts to gerrymander, making some votes irrelevant. You see these efforts to have voter suppression. And you see efforts to actually overturn elections, valid elections, and you see efforts supported by what we refer to as the big lie. The big lie that certain elections weren't valid. This is all common parlance in white Christian nationalism, which supports fascism. It's a Christian fascism in this country. And it's growing. It's growing. And you see now that they have support in the Supreme Court, which is now doing its best to erase that line of separation between church and state. And this event in Georgia by this group called Flashpoint Live, a group of evangelicals. They describe themselves as evangelicals. And what they did is, and you can go online, you can find this. They recited this thing called the Watchman Decree, the Watchman's Decree. And it will chill you to the bone. And they talk about, they said, we have been given the legal power from heaven and now exercise our authority. Because of our covenant with God, they say, we are equipped and delegated by God to destroy every attempted advance of the enemy. So you have this militant form of Christianity, which claims to be the arm of God and the authority, the governmental authority here on earth. And they claim to speak for all Christians. And so what they want to do is they want to impose their understanding of Christianity on everyone else, and they want to impose their understanding of Christianity on all non-Christians and all unbelievers. And an activist who saw this said that this is a crystal fascist ceremony. That's what it was. And so what do they want? What does the Christian fascist want? Well, a guy named Chris Hedges gave a speech, and he lists some things that he says that they're clear about, the kind of society that they intend to create. He said, in their ideal America, our secular human society based on science and reason will be destroyed. The Ten Commandments will form the basis of the legal system. Creationism or intelligent design will be taught in public schools, many of which will be overtly Christian. Those branded as social deviants, including the LGBTQ community, immigrants, secular humanists, feminists, Jews, Muslims, criminals, and those dismissed as nominal Christians, that's us, by the way, meaning Christians who do not embrace their particular form of biblical interpretation, will be imprisoned, silenced, or killed. Most governmental assistance programs and federal departments, including education, will be terminated. This is in their vision. Church organizations will be funded and empowered to run social welfare agencies in schools. The poor, condemned for sloth, indolence, and sinfulness, will be denied help. The death penalty will be expanded to include moral crimes, including apostasy, blasphemy, sodomy, and witchcraft, as well as abortion, which will be treated as murder. Hedges continues. He says, women denied contraception, access to abortion, and equality under the law will be subordinate to men. Those who practice other faiths will become, at best, second-class citizens. The wars waged by the American Empire will be defined as religious crusades. Victims of police violence and those in prison will have no redress. There will be no separation of church and state. And he concludes, those who defy Christian authorities at home or abroad, will be condemned as agents of Satan. So it's particularly important that as people of faith, or those of us who consider ourselves to be followers of Jesus, who consider ourselves to be Christian, it's particularly important for us to be paying attention. Because, you know, it can happen here. That we are not morally superior to the people of Germany, which found their nation overrun and controlled by fascism. It can happen here. And it can happen, but not without the support of this imposter form of Christianity that provides the cover, that provides the hatred, that provides the oxygen for this unholy alliance that we call fascism. And so it's particularly incumbent upon us to stand up for the true faith, for the love and the justice and the compassion of Jesus, for all people. For all people. You know, it's often forgotten that the Christian tradition was itself born out of resistance to an authoritarian empire. It was hunted down and it was persecuted by a nation that was run amok and that was described in the scriptures as the beast. If you read the Revelation, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about the Roman government that had turned into the beast. Revelation is not about something in the future. It's about something that was happening right then and there, and they used coded language because they were being hunted down and persecuted. And if you don't understand the historical context of Revelation, you can't understand the meaning of it today. And so, in fact, this first generation of Jesus' followers were those who were hunted down by the beast. And those first followers were all nonviolent. They were pacifists. They were conscientious objectors. They refused to fight in the Roman wars. And so the book of Revelation is not some shallow prediction of future events, but rather it spoke to the present conditions under this brutal, totalitarian rule of Nero. It's a book about courageous resistance of people of faith to a violent and repressive empire. Something that we should remember in these days. You know, after the Constitutional Convention of 1787, a woman famously asked Franklin what kind of government had been adopted, and he famously said, "A republic if you can keep it." Can we keep it? You know, because a democratic republic is not an easy, automatic thing. Let me conclude by using, this is a passage from Thomas Merton. And he talked about false images of God. And he said this, "Strong hate, the hate that takes joy in hating, is strong because it does not believe itself to be unworthy and alone. It feels the support of a justifying God, of an idol of war, an avenging and destroying spirit." And he said, "From such a blood-drinking God, the human race was once liberated." And he's talking about Christianity. He's talking about the way of Jesus, which liberated us from this bloodthirsty God. And he said, "But humanity is consequently returning to those old war gods, the gods that insatiably drink blood. It is easier to serve the hate gods because they thrive on the worship of collective fanaticism. To serve the hate gods, one only has to be blinded by collective passion. To serve the God of love, one must be free. One must face the terrible responsibility of the decision to love in spite of all unworthiness, whether in oneself or in one's neighbor." May we follow the God of love and not the false God of hate. Amen.